This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, this is Simon Mayo. In a moment, this week's film reviews with Mark as ever. After that, you can hear my interview with one of the UK's leading directors. He is Danny Boyle, and he came in to talk about his new movie, which is called Slumdog Millionaire. Dear R&B, says Paul in Twickenham. By the way, he says that's Rhythm and Blues, not Ross and Brand. Just wondered who you chaps would vote for in the US elections next week. My vote would have to be for John McCain, especially after he rescued those hostages from the Nakatomi Tower on Christmas Eve. Do you like that?
Boom, and if you will, boom. Very good. We haven't seen him in a vest, though, have we?
No, that's right. I don't think he gets away with a vest anymore, particularly. Vote John McCain because he can rescue you if you're stuck as a hostage on Christmas Eve.
Isn't he McLean in the film?
Yes.
Isn't in Dial, isn't he McLean? So doesn't that gag then fall down?
It's still still not a bad joke, is it? McCain, John McLean. I mean, it's not far
off.
Yeah,
OK, fine. Yeah, fine. Moving swiftly on.
Entirely spoiled that now.
No, but because you were saying
that's
like
quite
it.
Good,
that's quite good. But in fact, of course, it's John McClane. Anyway, carry on.
I think everyone else had worked that one out.
Okay.
James in Leeds, dear Dr. Fisher and Bob, my friends and I, all avid podcast listeners, are planning a horror DVD marathon at the weekend. No such marathon will be complete without a selection of quality zombie flicks. We've all seen Romero's work and recent classics like... Now, do you say REC? Brackets, R-E-C, close brackets, REC?
You do, but you have to say open square brackets, REC, close square brackets.
Well, he hasn't got square brackets, he's got round brackets.
Because it's like record. It's like it's the thing that comes up when you press record on a video
but it's
recorder.
It's that.
REC, yeah.
So, REC, and we were hoping that the good doctor could recommend something that we could get our teeth into.
A zombie movie?
Yes, please.
Well, I mean...
Can't say 28 Days Later because it's not really a zombie movie.
No, although that, I think, is that's a moot point. Because the whole point about 28 Days Later, they said, well, they're not zombies because they're not dead, they're infected. But in fact, they are, to all intents and purposes, you know, zombies. They're fast zombies. And I know technically they're not, but they are, in fact, zombies. I would, in that case, say 28 Days Later. I mean, funnily enough, the one that you always end up going back to is something like Zombie Flesh Eaters, just because it was around at the time of the video Nasty Scare and it was, you know, cut for a long time. And, you know, funnily enough, I ended up watching a bit of it a couple of years ago. And I mean, it's rubbish, but it's not bad rubbish. But the Romeros are the high water mark of that stuff, and you can always go back. I mean, if you watch something like Night of the Living Dead, which people forget just how grim Night of the Living Dead is, because Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead were much more scrungy and much more sort of special effects driven, but Night of the Living Dead is incredibly harrowing, and it is completely unsurpassed. It's brilliant.
Lisa on this email says, dear Zac and Efron, I'll be happy to be your token woman shout out. I'm not an actress or even remotely famous, but I wrote and directed my first film called Maconey's List, named after your colleague Stuart Maconey, after winning the Duke City Shootout Film Festival in the States last year. Wow. I now live in Los Angeles, listen to the podcast every week as I ride my bike along the Venice Beach path. I found that Mark's voice makes me pedal harder. I like that sentence because I don't know whether that's a compliment or not. Anyway,
your voice makes me pedal harder, yes.
Yes. Lisa says, I'm currently writing a feature-length rom-com, and at the front of my mind at all times is that if the film ever gets made, it has to be good enough to avoid a Commodian rant. I've been known to wake up in a cold sweat in the middle of the night, having been on the end of one of his 15-minute classics. It's scarier than Saw, and that is more than enough to make me try harder. Looking forward to hearing my name on the programme. I might cycle into a sand dune in shock, but it'll be worth it. Yours in place of Kira, and that's Lisa. So for this week only, Lisa Marks, hello.
And also we have to say hello to Charlotte, the bassist of the Subways, who is not... That's not a token woman inclusion. There's a very good reason for saying hello to her. So we are no longer an all-male club.
And what is that? And what is that very good reason?
I played with them and I like them and I know them. I mean, you know, what else do you want? What better reason does, for example, David Morrissey have? You know him, you like him, you say hello to him.
Hello, Dave. Well, and he listens, and he's the next doctor.
He is the next doctor in the next doctor, but he may not be the next doctor.
Exactly. And hello to Jason. And
can I just say that the moment at which I completely lost all faith in Matthew McFadyen was the moment in which he said, I'm not really a Doctor Who fan. I was listening to him thinking, he's great, he's intelligent, smart, I'm going to go home and watch that Little Dorrit. And then he said, I don't like Doctor Who. I'm sorry.
He's not in
it's
it.
It's all over.
He's he's not in it.
No, it doesn't matter whether he's in it. I'm not in Doctor Who, hello, as far as I know, and I love it.
Dear M and Q, in this week's Radio Times regular What I'm Watching column, Rory Bremner says, Five Live has some really good broadcasters. Victoria Derbyshire, Simon Mayo, his Friday afternoon spot with Mark Kermode reviewing the films is brilliant radio. Despite the fact he's clearly not female, says Rick in Bucks, MCSA, MSCE, they're Microsoft badges. Does that warrant at least one hello?
It does.
So hello to Rory Bremner.
Hello to Rory Bremner. Hello to Jason Isaacs.
And I think I've already done that. But you were too busy interrupting me to notice. So, and also, Fairport Convention and Old Prog Rock Tight. So we'll give you a box office top ten. Tantalise with the movies that are coming up then, Mark.
OK, well, it's a fantastic week because this is the week that the Terence Davis of Time and the City opens, which, if you remember when I was at the Cannes Film Festival this time, I said it was far and away the best thing that I saw. So there's that. There's also Hunger, the movie by Steve McQueen. Steve McQueen, the director, not Steve McQueen, the guy who jumped over the fence on the motorbike, obviously. So those two movies are, you know, great cause for rejoicing.
But for everyone in the normal world,
Quantum of Solace
again. Quantum of Solace.
There's no better person to sit opposite on a Monday morning and to have a laugh with.
Nikki and Sheila.
It just is fantastic to know that the person that you sit across the table from in the morning is great fun.
She really tries to make the programme a quality product. She really cares about that and the journalism in it.
Peter and Anita.
I really love fighting with him, discussing things with him, shaping ideas with him.
Five Live Breakfast, weekday mornings from 6, and Five Live Drive, weekday afternoons from 4, on Five Live.
Can I just ask, why haven't we got one of those trails with me going, oh, yeah, I love being across the desk from Simon. He always brings out the very best in me.
I don't know. We should do one.
Okay, we should do one of them. Okay,
let's do it now.
Do it now. Okay.
The thing I like about Mark is that he comes in and he always buys me coffee.
Yeah. The thing I like about Simon is he's always there.
Yeah. That's not going to be very good, is
no,
it?
Not
that's
really,
why
no.
They didn't ask us.
Okay.
Movie top 10 this week with reviews to come. Thanks for all the emails. Let's do number 10. Tropic Thunder is there.
On the way out of the top ten, still, same as I said before, it is funny, but it's not funny enough. It would have been funnier had they had half the budget. There is some stuff that's risky in it. It's nice to see Robert Downey Jr. doing that stuff, but it is, in the end, too baggy for its own good.
City of Embers at 9.
With apologies to Toby Jones, who, you know, I absolutely love Toby Jones. I think he's a brilliant actor. I think he's really, really terrific in Frost Nixon. When he was on the show and you were interviewing him and you asked him whether or not he thought that Frost Nixon looked stagey on film, it absolutely doesn't. I mean, it absolutely doesn't. It's a terrific feature film. The problem with City of Ember is I genuinely don't know who it's aimed at. I mean, it's kind of a kid's movie with aspirations towards something greater, and I think in the end it fails. It looks extraordinary, but it doesn't hang together.
It's Mamma Mia at 8 and Tim Wilson in New York, New York. Simon and Mark just letting you know that there is a story behind Kevin Spacey intoning Mamma Mia, now and forever. The tagline for the Broadway production of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cats was actually Cats, now and forever. And you couldn't escape it on the posters plastered on the subway walls and neighbourhood billboards. Thank heavens there's no truth in advertising. Cats finally closed here several years ago. All the best from Tim Wilson. Just to explain. 7, How to Lose Friends and Alienate People.
I mean, the thing is, it has done well. It's done well at the British box office. I don't think it's a brilliant film. I think that whatever bite and sort of sass there was in the novel has had all the edges taken off it in order to make it into a film that appealed to a mainstream audience. It was interesting. When I saw it, I thought it's not going to work. I didn't think it would appeal to a mainstream audience. The fact that it stayed around in the top 10, that it's, you know, it's done as well as it has, proves that I was wrong in judging that it wasn't going to do what it was aiming to do. I still don't like what it did. I mean, I would still like something to be more edgy and you know, it's, for me, it's a bit fluffy. But on the other hand, it does seem to have had mass appeal, at least here anyway, if not, you know, if not across the pond. So, you know, congratulations to them for that. I don't like the film, though.
And starring the great Liam Neeson, Taken, is at 6.
It's great, you know. He runs around a lot and then he shoots some people and then it ends. But and who's driving the boat? And has anybody yet done the thing, which I've asked them to do, which is at the end, stand up and say, oi, who's driving the boat?
I think someone did it a couple of weeks ago, but no one has said that since. If we have any eyewitness accounts, let us know. Mirrors at 5.
A remake of a film which didn't make much sense in the original language version now doesn't make any more sense in the English language version. A couple of nice creepy set pieces, but nothing more than that, and essentially disposable.
The House Bunny is at 4.
I mean, it's funny how much I dislike The House Bunny. It's kind of out of whack with just how bad of a film. I mean, it's a rubbish film. Oh, yeah, that's it. It's a rubbish film. That's absolutely fine. Nobody need trouble themselves with it at all. But I think the thing that's most rubbish about it is this kind of incredibly devious way in which it ends up being an advert for, you know, how the Playboy boss is the greatest guy on earth, and actually he's a really caring, sharing individual, and we should all love him in an avuncular way. I'm not having it. I mean, no.
Igor's at 3.
And you've well done for saying Igor, because it does actually say on the poster E-E-G-O-R. And I can't look at it without thinking Igor Froderick, Frankenstein. I mean, it's not a great animation. It's kind of like a Tim Burton movie with all the Tim Burton taken out of it. Now, if you're going to watch this kind of thing, you might as well just go home, get out The Corpse Bride on DVD, which is, you know, infinitely superior.
Eagle Eye, is it 2?
More running around and jumping and shouting and things blowing up, and somewhere in the middle of it all, there's a sort of 70s-style conspiracy thriller plot going on, but it gets completely lost amidst the Bayified turn everything up to 11 and blow everything up all the time. I mean, it's a film with no modulation. It just starts and then it shouts and then it runs along shouting and then it stops. And I found it quite boring as a result of it. I do find that after things have blown up, you know, just solidly for about half an hour, I just lose all interest. And that is a Bond issue.
It is indeed. More Bond in a moment. Burn After Reading, though, however, is still the UK's number one movie.
Well, it just goes to show that if you get a whole... I mean, funnily enough, when I reviewed it and I said how much I didn't like it, and I said what it was it's basically just a bunch of, you know, handsome, intelligent people playing stupid, ugly people, but they're all famous people. And it's a load of bits, and it's a load of Brad Pitt's bits. And I said, of course, what will happen is it'll go to number one and everyone will go and say, oh, yeah, I saw that, but after, oh, it's really funny. Oh, Brad Pitt, he plays this goofy character, and George Clooney plays this. Well, that's exactly what's happened. Exactly what I said was going to happen has happened. People have gone along for the kind of novelty value of seeing Brad Pitt with a funny haircut and seeing George Clooney with a beard and some kind of tick and, you know, a nut intolerance, and you know, well, as I said, I'm wacky intolerant, and hey, you want to spend your money, go and see that, fine. You know, all the other Coen Brothers movies are available on DVD. If I were you, I'd go back to one of the old ones. I mean, if you want to see something that's good from the Coens, go and get Blood Simple out. I mean, Blood Simple still stands up. It's still a wonderful piece of work. You know, get out any of the early funny ones. They are funnier than this.
Dr. David Dunn, MB, BAO, BCH in Derry, says, amongst other things, there's a long email about The Big Lebowski, which he triggered a couple of weeks back. He concludes by saying, I went to see Burn After Reading, and I agree with absolutely everything the good doctor said, but I still chuckled my way through the whole thing and had a very good night's entertainment. The most talked about movies, as far as the emails are concerned, are Quantum of Solace and High School Musical 3.
Fantastic.
An absolute tirade on the subject. But let's just do a couple of the Quantum of Solace issues. Dear Junior and Krug, says Stephen in Solihull, loads of things. He saw it this morning. Camera seemed only to sit still for a brief moment when the audience was allowed to admire either Bond's designer suit or Daniel Craig's state of undress. Impressive as it may be, you can't hang a feature film on it. Not a mainstream one anyway. Still, I'm seeing the wonderful Nosferatu with live organ accompaniment tonight, so my film-going day will improve.
Fantastic.
This from Jack in Blackburn. No, it is Jack Blackburn, in fact, and he's in Oxford. Dear Liverpool and Everton, I'm going to see Quantum of Solace tomorrow, but if both doctors' diagnoses are correct, I'm in for a disappointment. I'm willing to forgive it until the next time round, as I can understand the studio pushing for the release in the wake of the writer's strike, even if the film was not at its best. However, the amount of marketing is somewhat sickening. Dr. K has already mentioned the video game, but wondered why it was called Quantum of Solace, as there was nothing in the film that had this obscure title made sense, although there is one reference towards the end. Could it be that when you stack the words on top of each other, the O's in Of and Solace line up nicely?
That could be right. Funnily enough, I read a review of the film today which said that the criminal organisation is called Quantum. Is that right?
Well, there is a reference to Quantum right at the very
end. Yes, I mean, there is a reference to Quantum, but it's like it's not like Smursh or Thrush or any of those. It's not like one of those names. It just turns up at the very end of the film. Somebody says a sentence which has the word quantum in it.
That's someone being James Bond, I think.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter who says it. It's just the fact that they actually have to have quantum in the film at some point.
Len in Leeds. Dear Duran Duran and Barbarella, went to the 10:30 Bond show this morning, heaving with people, and I'm confused. The film is long enough. The stunt's excellent. There are some great Bond quips. The theme tune was really good. And I understand the plot. Even a nod to Goldfinger. So am I missing something here? It's just really good. But it is the first time I've been bag-searched before going into the cinema, apparently because it doesn't open in the States for a fortnight. Why isn't it opening in the USA? I don't know. But Len, completely convinced, loves it to bits.
Well, the reason, I mean, we get it here first because, it's a Bond movie, and therefore they're leading on the Britishness, and that's all absolutely fine. Of course we should have the Bond movies opening first. And, of course, the movie is going to take an enormous amount of money, and, of course, everyone's going to go and see it. And, in fact, I don't think I'd say that people don't go and see it, because it's a Bond movie. You pretty much have to see every Bond movie that comes out. But as far as this thing about the plot not making sense is concerned, I didn't think it made sense. You didn't think it made sense. Loads of other people I've spoken to didn't think it made sense. And the key reason it didn't make sense wasn't just the kind of obfuscation of the plot, which I think is a problem, because I don't think it's narratively well put together at all. It does feel like something which has been, written with a trowel. I think that you just get disinterested. You just get not disinterested, uninterested. Disinterested is the other one. You get bored. And the minute you stop wanting to understand, that's when everything really falls apart. And I do think that the key problem with this film is there is no emotional involvement. Now, you saw it in the same screening that I did, right? Did you feel emotionally involved with the characters?
No, but I suppose no in comparison with Casino Royale, because you did. But in the tradition of Bond films, just you don't get emotionally involved with anyone, really, do you?
Well,
you
I just don't know. I don't think that's true. I think that even in the old Bond movies, the ones that we now think of as slightly camp, there is an absolute engagement with the character of James Bond, and the whole movie is played to the tenor of the character. So whichever different Bond you had, I mean, it's very different to have Roger Moore and to have Sean Connery, but the films were kind of pegged around that. The problem with this is they've got Daniel Craig, who's a terrific actor, who's given us the most three-dimensional Bond we've ever had, and yet the story doesn't know what to do with him. I mean, I think that's the thing that bothers me so much. When you've got Daniel Craig, when you've got the potential to reinvent the series in the way that they did with Casino Royale, when you've got pretensions towards doing something that's dramatically interesting, why then just say, oh, let's have another chase sequence? Let's have another chase sequence.
Craig says, dear Ham and Hi, the good doctor was spot on about Quantum of Solace. Total mess from beginning to end. Too many chases, no idea what was happening. And a baddie whose most devilish moment involved upping the cost of a utilities contract. And how evil can you get? And Gemma Arterton was awful too. Can we have some fun next time, please, and a plot that makes sense? Dear Andy and Tim, just a quick thought on Bond. Could we not compare the release of a Bond movie to a Brit appearing at Wimbledon? Hopeful, but eventually disappointing. B in Walsall, dear yourself and Irene, went to see Burn after reading. Does yourself agree it's the longest setup for 10 minutes of good stuff at the end? Paul in Ealing, Quantum of Solace, saw it last night. The next Bond film had better be really good and use all the setup that it's had from this movie, because it was truly dreadful mishmash of action and no plot. Was I supposed to study the underplot more than the film? Is an underplot a subplot?
I think so. Yeah,
never heard it called an underplot before.
No, but I was with the email up until that point because I agree with the sentiment. So I'm going to say yes. Of course, everyone's heard the word underplot, Simon. Where did you go to college?
But you'd never actually heard of that word before.
No, I'm pretending now that I have. Yes.
David in Sunderland, dear Jules, an odd job. Pants are the only way to describe Question of Sport. Bring back a story, bring back the girls, the gags and the gadgets. But, of which I think everyone has acknowledged there's not a lot. Well, the girls are there.
Yes.
And the explosions, but no gags and no gags. But maybe there were too many gags and gadgets, and that's the point.
No, but the thing is, there are different types of Bond movies. There are Bond movies which are essentially gags and gadgets. I mean, there is, of course, in the case of the original Casino Royale, there is a Bond movie which is a broad comedy. There are Bond movies which are tough action movies. When Timothy Dalton came on board, they were attempting at that point to sort of change the series and make it, slightly tougher, slightly harder-edged, and they lost some of the audience at that point. But the thing is, it has to be whatever it is. It's not that it has to be like the other movies. It has to be whatever it is, but whatever it is has to stand up on its own. And the worst thing about Quantum of Solace is it doesn't stand up on its own terms. You can do whatever you want with Bond. You can do it campy and funny and gadgety, or you can do it dead straight and serious, but you have to do one or the other. In the case of Quantum of Solace, you sit there thinking, what are you trying to do? Why do you keep having these conversations about how, guilt-ridden and angst-ridden and betrayed Bond feels, and then just losing the nerve and then blowing everything up like Michael Bay was directing it? And when it's a Mark Forster film, why is he doing it?
Because he wanted to and was paid lots of money.
Well, Simon, that's imagining the lowest common denominator. I mean, but yes, you're probably right.
Lots and lots of correspondence to try and work through before 4 o'clock, overwhelmingly about High School Musical 3.
Hey!
However, before we get sidetracked into that, let's discuss something that might be new this week and worthy of our attention.
Well, let's do Of Time and the City, which is the new movie by Terence Davis. It's his first film since House of Mirth, which I think was 2000. It was like 8 years ago. He kind of pretty much stopped making films. One of the worst things about this country is that we have great filmmakers who, if they were working in like Europe, for example, would just be treated like Fellini, and you know, would be allowed to sort of carry on working because they knew, everyone knew they were great artists. Over here, we have this kind of some extraordinary filmmakers, people like Terence Davis, people like Ken Russell, people like Nick Rogue, who have made masterpieces and have difficulty getting movies financed. I mean, it's a shocking truth. We have these really terrific, great filmmakers, internationally renowned filmmakers, and they have difficulty financing films. And Terence Davis hasn't made a film now. I think it's the best part of 8 years. So now what we have is this. It's like a very personal documentary, and it's a documentary about his memories of Liverpool and growing up in Liverpool. For those who don't know, Terence Davis did things like Distant Voices Still Live and Neon Bible, and he made a thing called the Terence Davis Trilogy, which is very sort of, you know, well known on the festival circuit. And when Danny Boyle was talking about the importance of festivals, I saw Of Time in the City in Cannes, and I went in, I have to say, with sort of, you know, fairly low expectations, because all I knew was it was a documentary, and what I wanted from Terence Davis was a feature film. And I got a feature film and so much more. Essentially, what you have is a collection of old footage mixed with some new footage that he's taken himself, and a voiceover with Terence Davis reading a selection of prose and poetry, very, very heavily layered music, and some original script. Here's a little taste of it. And the thing is, I absolutely love the sound of Terence Davis's voice, and I think even just hearing this clip gives you a sense of, you know, the splendour of the movie itself. Here we go.
Come closer now. Here was my whole world. Home, school, the movies, and God. Come closer now and see your dreams. Come closer. See mine.
Oh, blimey.
No, I'm sorry, but couldn't you listen to that voice just for the whole of the rest of the day?
Not really, no.
Really? Oh, well, there we go.
Is the film better than that?
Well, that's rather like somebody looking at the Mona Lisa and going, is that all? You know, or that, you know, that Leonardo da Vinci. What's all that about then? No, look, I thought this was, I mean, certainly it was the best thing I saw at Cannes. It is currently pretty much my favourite film of the year, I think. Here's what's so marvellous about it. What Terence Davis does is to create this completely personal picture of the city. I mean, some people who saw it, when I was in Cannes, John Harris was there, and he said, how can you make a documentary about Liverpool without doing things like Toxteth? The point is that those aren't the things that are significant in Davis's life. What's significant for him is the street that he grew up on, in the relationship with his family, his intense relationship with the church, his then intense falling out with the church as he discovered his own sort of dormant sexuality. I mean, I went back to Liverpool with him. I was doing a piece about the film, and we stood on the street where he had grown up, and he virtually pointed. He said, that's the place where I was effectively cast out of paradise, when I suddenly realised that I wasn't like other people. I didn't fit in with other people. And what the film manages to do is, on the one hand, it's incredibly funny. I mean, that's the one thing you don't get from that clip. It's really ribald. It's really fruity and rich and, you know, really, it's got that marvellous kind of radio play quality to it. But on the other hand, it's poignant and heartbreaking and intensely personal. But I think the most important thing is it's incredibly accessible. I think absolutely anybody could sit down and watch Of Time in the City and just be swept away by the power of his memory. I mean, the interesting thing about it is it's a film about trying to get back to childhood, trying to recapture a sort of sense of paradise before it was lost. And it's incredibly universal. He's a fantastic storyteller. He's a real visual poet. He's put together this, you know, montage of material that he's gathered together from an enormous array of sources. And sitting there in Cannes, you know, obviously the British people who kind of understood the stuff that was being talked about, but it was an international audience, and of course they were reading the subtitles with Davis's voice, and it was going down just as well with them. And I sat there next to Mark Cousins, and we were both in floods of tears.
You cried at High School Musical 3.
You know, I know, but you somehow think that invalidates crying at anything else. I mean, joyful tears. I mean, I sat there and I felt the film sweeping over me, and I'm so excited about it because there have been some rubbish movies around recently, but Of Time in the City is just one of those magical things when you think, that's it, it's screen poetry. And we both, you know, we came out of the screening, we turned to each other and just said, well, that's it, you're not going to see anything better than that, are you? That is it. And I've seen it a couple of times since then now, and every time it's just completely swept me away. I think the thing to stress is just how funny it is, just how, you know, accessible it is, just how enrapturing it is. It's not going to be one of those experiences when you go then you sit and you grit your teeth thinking, oh, I've got to watch a documentary about Liverpool by Terence Davies. You really, really get carried away in it, and it's wonderful. Go and see it. I know that you're not convinced by this at all, but
no,
believe me, even from the point that you're at now of thinking, well, it's just some bloke talking and reading poetry over black and white images of Liverpool, go see it. It's profound. It has stuff to say about sexuality, about religion, about personality, about childhood, about adulthood, about the state of the nation now, about the way in which the Liverpool which he remembers isn't the Liverpool of today, the fact that he's walking roads that you cannot walk again. It's genuinely philosophically profound and laugh out loud funny, and I loved it.
Is it fair to say you might miss out on that, you know, Friday night, we've got a babysitter, let's go and see a movie. One of your friends says, let's go and see a black and white documentary with poetry about Liverpool.
Well, it's not a black and white documentary. There are black and white things in it. And also, right, I think, crucially, it's not a documentary, really. The thing it reminded me of is the Guy Madden film, My Winnipeg, which is this kind of docu-fantasia. It looks like a documentary, but in fact, it's an incredibly personal and actually largely fanciful reminiscence about the town. And I know that people won't say, well, you know, let's do that for Friday evening, let's go see Quantum of Solace. I guarantee you, here's the thing, if you go see Quantum of Solace, right, you'll get bored. If you go see A Time in the City, you will come out, you will be uplifted, you will feel better, you will walk with a spring in your step. And you can also leave the cinema in the knowledge that you made the right decision. You've made the right decision, you backed the right horse. You went to see the movie by Terry Davis, not the stupid Bond film.
Yeah, I don't think people get bored in Quantum of Solace. They might get baffled, but they won't get bored. No one will get bored. In fact, there's no one that gets bored.
No, what do you mean no one got bored? I got bored of
it.
Yeah,
but apart from you, and you don't count, see? There's no one else in the real world who will get bored.
Right. Please text us in if you see Quantum of Solace and found yourself at any point getting bored. Well, I guarantee you. Yeah, there'll be a welter of texts if people got bored.
Ellie on this says, Dear Pazuzu and Damien, my husband and I were...
Did you get that?
Course, went to see a living legend of film last week who was talking to William Friedkin. It was very good to see you in person, Dr. Kerman. We're looking forward to spending Halloween with pumpkin soup, a couple of large pillows to hide behind, and The Exorcist, the version you've never seen. Two questions. One, last night we went to see the mesmerising Of Time in the City.
Oi!
See, you can see why I read this out?
No, I can't now. I thought you were just reading it to be nice to me.
I was utterly absorbed in Davis's wonderful film until I was forcibly distracted by a woman with a carrying voice a few rows behind me, who thought it necessary to whisper throughout most of the last third of the film.
Oh, no.
Being too far away to subtly ask, but should I have stood up and loudly asked her to shut up? I thought about it, but like the nice, repressed English girl I am, I sat and seethed, unable to enjoy the end of a remarkable 73 minutes. Two, as you always run out of time, couldn't Mark start at 2 o'clock, and then he'd have plenty of time for more glorious wittertainment without having to rush it at the end, especially if you have to pause, Dr. Kermode, mid-flow for some niggling little interruption like US presidents or sports results? Thank you. You're the best start to the weekend. Anyway,
well,
so...
Listen, that thing about people talking in cinemas, I mean, it is terrible. And the thing I've always said about it is you wouldn't talk in church, why do it in a cinema? I mean, that is how I feel about it. And the other thing that leads me on to say, which I was going to say about Terence Davis, is that, of course, when he fell out of love with the church, he fell into love with the cinema. And actually, the cinema became like his sort of spiritual home. And there's an awful lot of stuff in Of Time in the City, which is all about the experience of being transported by the cinema, which again, you know, connects for me very strongly. But I'm so thrilled that somebody's written in saying that they enjoyed it just as much, and how terrible that somebody was talking through it.
Daryl in Wandsworth, Tango and Cash's regular podcast listener. I was just looking forward to standing up at the cinema to shout, "Who's driving the boat?"
Hey!
Whilst watching Taken this week. As the moment arrived, imagine my disappointment when it was obvious that as Liam was discovered on the boat, the bad guys driving simply switched on the autopilot, grabbed a gun and prepared to be dispatched in a variety of interesting ways. Surely in such an expensive boat, yacht, the answer was simple. Perhaps the interview of the mumbling Liam had scrambled your brains. On a final note, I'm sure Mark is delighted that The Exorcist was voted the best horror again in a poll this week.
It was.
Keep up the programme, and for heaven's sake, don't phone Andrew Sachs. Daryl in Wandsworth. I don't think we're planning to do that. Tim in the south of France, please remember Sunday the 2nd is Dave Pegg's 61st birthday. Wish him a happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Dave Pegg.
From Fairport Convention. And this, just for listeners of a certain age, Nick says, Dear Glengarry and Glen Ross, I went to see the Duchess the other day and there wasn't a single mention of Jimmy Savile's mother. Am I entitled to my mother, to my money back? So it's not even explaining that. So let's take some travel with Louise. And what's new that's next, Mark?
Hunger.
We'll do some hunger in just a moment. Louise, first of all.
Thank you, Simon. The M62. Still slow going if you're travelling east from around 24 through to 27, Huddersfield and Gildersham. I've just been looking at junction 27 on the cameras. It's very heavy. Can't see a reason for it. Can't see any restrictions. Just looks like it's the sheer volume of traffic. The M1, we've got two lanes closed northbound, 22 to 23, Colville and Loughborough. Although I've just had a call from Jake who says the air ambulance has landed, so they may stop traffic completely on that stretch of the M1. The M25 is slow following an earlier accident that was anti-clockwise, 11 to 10, Chertsey and Wisley. Also slow following an earlier problem, anti-clockwise at 2 at the Darrenth interchange. Both of those problems have been moved to the hard shoulder. The A30 is all now open westbound at Redruth. The overturned lorry back on its wheels, and it looks like they've cleared the treacle up, which is good news.
That was quick.
It was very quick,
actually. You would imagine that takes quite a while.
Well, I'd heard that it had damaged the carriageway, so it looked like it was going to be ongoing for quite a while, but looks like it's all clear. But the A30, also in Cornwall, is still closed in both directions at the Innes Downs roundabout, and that one's all due to a police incident. Louise Perry, 5 Live Travel.
Are you prepared to take the constitutional oath?
I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability,
preserve, protect, and defend
the Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
Peter Allen.
So who will be the 44th President of the United States? John McCain or Barack Obama? 5 Live's going to have full coverage of the election across the country with Richard Bacon, John Pienaar, Leslie Ashmole and Rod Sharp. And, of course, on 5 Live Drive.
The 2008 US presidential election.
Election night coverage starts on Tuesday afternoon from 4 and will continue on Wednesday with analysis and reaction to the result.
The President of the United States.
The 2008 US presidential election.
On 5 Live.
Can I just apologise, as it is a week for apologies, due to entirely unforeseen circumstances, we gave you the wrong box office top 10.
You see, I was wondering what happened to High School Musical 3? Why wasn't it in there?
So the top 5 are Eagle Eye, Ghost Town, because Ghost Town, of course, wasn't
in there. Why wasn't Ghost Town in there?
Burn After Reading, Saw 5 is at 2, and High School Musical 3
is straight in at number 1. Thank heavens the world is all right again.
So Phil, on this... he's in Auckland, right? And a hark back to earlier, more simple times, I say, Dear Simon and Mark, recently emigrated to Auckland, so listening to the Film Review podcast is like falling into some weird time warp where I hear things 6 weeks in advance of when they're released. None more so than with High School Musical 3. I'm already having to suffer the it's so unfair calls from my 10-year-old daughter Rebecca that all our UK friends have seen High School Musical 3 while she has to wait until December. However, having heard last week's review, I have to tell you that the good doctor is completely right. HSM is a great feel-good movie with Ashley Tisdale, undoubtedly the star, a real scene stealer. HSM 2 isn't as good, but now I can look forward to HSM 3, as I will no doubt have to take Rebecca along, and I know that we'll be singing along in a Mamma Mia sort of way. And if you ever doubt my daughter's taste, we recently bought The Princess Bride, the first time that she's seen it, and the first time I've seen it since its cinema release, and she thinks it's one of the best films ever, and she was rolling on the floor during the Mowage ceremony. Listening from 11,000 miles away, that's Phil Henwood. This from Kevin Pegley, M.A., Cantab. Dear Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, listening to the podcast last week, High School Musical 3 brought home to me why he is truly in a class of his own. I see far too few films to be able reliably to correlate Mark's opinion with my own, but that's not the point. What matters is his passion, his honesty and his humanity. Give the man a pay rise. There are several well-paid openings at the BBC, apparently, including one for a film critic. As for Simon, well, every Cardinal Richelieu needs his Père Joseph.
Very good.
Kieran Madden, busy illustrating in Oxford. I was mesmerised to hear the good doctor give High School Musical 3 the thumbs up last week, even almost elevating it to Film of the Week status. His justification for doing so being that it provides exactly what the title says it will. Can I just put forward, though, the counter-argument that just because a film applies the Ron Seal effect to its title doesn't necessarily make it a good film. Case in point, the recent sorry excuse for a horror film that I was forced to watch by a friend, Zombie Strippers. Yes, it features zombie and strippers. Doesn't stop it from being rubbish, though.
No, but there's also a judgment call here, which is, you know, Zombie Strippers is a film which knows it's rubbish and is kind of it's trading on that older trauma thing about, you know, you have a movie called like a teenage nymphoid barbarian in dinosaur hell and everyone thinks, oh, that it's going to be funny, it's going to be so bad it's good. In fact, it's so bad it's just bad. In the case of High School Musical 3, it, you know, it doesn't think it's bad, it doesn't think it's rubbish, it thinks it's really good, and it is really good. And I'm actually quite shocked by how many critics gave High School Musical 3 one star. I genuinely think that the people who gave High School Musical 3 one star need to get a life, because they just don't know what they're talking about.
Here's Simon Prentice, who says, Dear Heaven and Hell, firstly, High School Musical 3 is... surely must win the Academy Award for Best Film of the Year. I can't remember having so much fun in a cinema ever, which is going some. I laughed, and just like the big girl Kermode, I cried. I am a 16-stone galoot, but it was beautiful. The singing and dancing eclipsed even Grease. Secondly, perhaps if you didn't waste the first half of your show by saying hello to a bunch of no-marks that aren't relevant to life, the world or anything, perhaps you, Mark, may then get to actually review the film of the week for a change. You never know. Keep up the wittertainment. And hello to Harry Redknapp. He concludes that. So we better, you know, in the spirit of that email, you better review something new.
Yeah, well, let's do Hunger, which is the first feature by Steve McQueen, who's kind of best known, I suppose, as an artist. He was a Turner Prize winner. And, again, this played at Cannes, and it won the Camera D'Or, which is the prize for, you know, debut feature. Steve McQueen did an installation, this thing, Queen and Country. He was the official war artist in Iraq in 2003, and he did a series of stamps, images of people who had, you know, lost their life in that conflict. And the idea was that they would become, you know, proper postage stamps, which hasn't happened yet, but there's an ongoing campaign for that to happen. And I thought it was very interesting and actually very well thought out, you know, work of art. And I tend to be rather cynical about people being in that area and then coming into filmmaking. In the case of this, what it is it's a film about the hunger strike, the IRA hunger strike, early 1980s, centering on the character of Bobby Sands. And it's a film which deals with a very, very difficult subject, but deals with it in a way which isn't exploitative, which is insightful, and to some extent, I think, owes a certain amount of debt to a film like The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. When Diving Bell and the Butterfly came out, I remember saying it may be that it takes an artist like Julian Schnabel to actually do something interesting about the process of death, about the process of the lack of physical strength. And to some extent, there is a little bit of that in Hunger. Anyway, I think we have a clip lined up. Let's hear a clip from Hunger.
So what makes it different from the last time?
Last hunger strike was flawed. It became emotional. 7 men started at the same time. They all got weak and they couldn't let the weakest one die, which left us susceptible to being conned by the Brits. And that's exactly what we were, conned. This time out, the men will start consecutively 2 weeks apart. Somebody dies, they'll be replaced. There's no shortage of us. 75 men have put their names forward.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
The announcement's being made today.
So what makes this protest different is that you're set to die, will we?
May well come to that.
You start a hunger strike to protest for what you believe in. You don't start already determined to die, or am I missing something here?
It's in their hands. Our message is clear. They're seeing our determination.
Now, there's in the middle of the film, which is largely kind of imagistic, there is this one central sequence, which is about 18 minutes long, which is a dialogue sequence between Bobby Sands and a priest. And it's done in pretty much one shot. And it's incredibly audacious. And I remember seeing it the first time, literally people kind of holding their breath, because it was like watching a tightrope act, because there were no cuts. For about the first quarter, like 15 minutes of it was completely uncut. It was just two guys round a table doing as if they were doing it as a play. And very, very intense. The rest of the movie is not dialogue heavy. The rest of the movie is very much to do with visual images. And I mean, a couple of things that have to be said about it. The first one is that obviously it's a film which makes comparisons between what happened back then and what's happening now. I mean, it is a film about prisoners and people dying for a cause, and the difference between terrorism and freedom fighting and, you know, sacrifice and murder. So it's about all of those things, but it doesn't ram those ideas down your throat, but it is quite clearly about those. I mean, you see images of prisoners, it's impossible not to compare it with modern circumstances. The second thing is that It's not overtly political. I mean, it's funnily enough, when I interviewed Steve McQueen about it, and he said, I said, do you have a clear political take on those events? Because, you know, obviously they're very controversial events. He said, no, but I have, what I have is a clear human take on those events. And I think, actually, although, you know, I think the movie does have a, obviously a degree of politics in it, in the end, it is a humanist film. It is a film about the people in the drama. And I think the third thing to say is that it often happens that people who come out of the art world, when they go into making films, they can't structure them properly. And it's often been the case that you see people coming from art, coming into cinema, and, I mean, most notably that ridiculous Tracy Emin movie, you know, which wasn't even a movie. I mean, it just literally wasn't even a proper movie. It was barely a television program. But in the case of this, it's like he's emerged almost fully formed as a proper director. And it's really well directed, very strongly played, an extraordinary central performance by Michael Fassbender, who, you know, you can see him just wasting away on screen. And it reminded me to some extent of Christian Bale's performance in that film, which I always get the title of it wrong. It's The Machinist or The Mechanic or whatever it is. I think it's The Machinist. And in which he literally, you know, lost a huge amount of weight. So when Michael Fassbender plays this part extraordinarily, you do genuinely believe that what you are watching is somebody wasting away, but you don't believe that you're watching it for exploitational purposes. I mean, obviously there will be a certain degree of controversy about any movie that deals with this subject, but in the end I think it deals with it in a way which is sensible and sensitive and artistically interesting, and I think that's the key to it.
Martin, BDSVU Mank in Old Portsmouth, a huge rant about every single movie that's out this week, but concludes with this interesting: has anyone yet played the Kermode Friday afternoon drinking game?
No.
Sundry mates each picks a catchphrase, so here it is: death of narrative cinema, I'm right, you're wrong, etc. And yep. Takes a drink when theirs is mentioned. All take a drink when The Exorcist is mentioned. All drinks are drained at a rant. Best played with shandy if it's a Pirates weekend. An interesting idea.
We hadn't mentioned The Exorcist until just then.
I did.
And that's... Yeah, well, I didn't, but you, so we, I was using the... I thought, you know, we're a team, aren't we?
That's right.
So 3 minutes
that's
to four,
right.
That must be a record for how long we got through the show without mentioning The Exorcist.
It might be 3 minutes to four in Southampton. It's 2 minutes to four in the rest of the world.
Oh, is it? Okay, fine. I'm sorry.
Carlton, who's listening in Tokyo, said, now this is from last week, regarding your comments about one character film titles. This is because we're talking about W. You remember that?
Yeah.
I've already heard American comedian Stephen Colbert referring to Oliver Stone's new film W as a prequel to Spike Lee's X.
Very
which
good.
I think works very well.
Good.
And thanks
that's
to Jeremy
good.
in Sydney, Australia, for a whole list of letter-based movies. A is for Acid, S Club, The Wrong Q, Z and Two Noughts, and so on. It's a work of art. Is there anything else you'd like to mention? Maybe the movie of the week in our last 60 seconds.
Well, I've told you the movie of the week is Of Time and the City. That is the movie of
the black and white Liverpool thing.
It's not. I mean, there is some
black and
white.
That's what you said. It's a documentary in black and white about going to Liverpool with poetry.
You know, what I said was, you said it's what I said. I correct you. I said it's not a black and white documentary. It is a documentary that has some black and white film in it. There are other bits of it that are in colour. And it's and the point about it is, were you not listening to any of this? It's not really a documentary. What it is it's a eulogy. That's what it is. It's a eulogy. It's a poetic cinematic eulogy, and it's one of, and please believe me, go see it. You will leave with a huge smile on your face and a spring in your step and the knowledge that the world is a better place and you've contributed to making it so.
Either that or High School Musical 3 again.
Or High School Musical 3, which is fantastic, and I'm so thrilled that our listeners know more than those stupid film critics out there who gave it one star. Shame on them.
And it is the number one. Mark, thanks very much indeed. Have a fantastic weekend. We're back on Monday
on DAB Digital Radio, digital TV, downloads and online.
This is 5 Live.
Danny is here. His new movie, Slumdog Millionaire, closed the London Film Festival last night to a pretty rapturous reception, Danny.
Yeah, it was very good, yeah.
They loved it.
Yeah, they did, didn't they? It was amazing, really. It was wonderful to get home, because we've been playing it in America, really, because it's been picked up there and we've been at a few festivals there, and it was amazing to get it home, because there's a bit in the film about cricket, so it's nice to play it somewhere where they understand the game.
Yeah.
And Sachin Tendulkar means something, you know? Like, whereas over there, it's like, what? What are these guys on about, you know?
So, when you came in last time, we should talk about Sunshine. I think you alluded to this story. I think you knew what was coming up, because you were telling us about this story, or just what it was in outline. Just explain the idea behind Slumdog Millionaire. We'll take some trouble and we'll do some more on it, but just explain what this story is and where we are for the story, Dan.
So it's about this kid from the slums of Mumbai, and he goes on, he's like 18, and he goes on the Hindi version, the Indian version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And seemingly without education, any kind of qualification at all, he wins it. He goes all the way to the top prize. And, of course, they think, everybody thinks he's cheated. The show, the police, everybody thinks he's cheated. In fact, they arrest him and start torturing him. And what you find out through the film is that he happens to know all the answers because of his life experiences. They happen to ask him questions that he knows about or he guesses correctly. The real reason that he's able to win it is that although the prize money is beyond belief in Indian terms, he's not really on it for the money, really. He's not like Sheikh Mansour Al, you know. He's actually got something else in mind. There's a different reason for him being on the show.
And it's all filmed in Mumbai, and it's pretty... I mean, unless you really, really know your Bollywood stars, we don't know anyone in this film, really.
No, you might know Dev Patel, actually. He's one of the guys from Skins.
Oh, yeah, OK. And also the man who plays Chris Tarrant. Or the equivalent, we might have seen him in a couple of movies.
He's called Anil Kapoor. He's a huge star in the Bollywood system. This is his first English language film. Wonderful actor as well, really wonderful actor. But Dev Patel will probably be recognisable to people because there's a lot of people know Skins, know those people who were in Skins. And I couldn't find... I wanted to cast it all in Bollywood because there's a lot of wonderful actors out there. But I couldn't find a guy that looked right for it because all the young guys out there, they're all built like bodybuilders. They're all, because they've got that look where they can rip their shirts off in the waterfall into the Swiss Alps or wherever they do the
bodybuilding. A bit like you and me, Danny. Yeah.
But they can't, but you look at them and you think, and also because they're quite young, their heads are still very small. So they've got these huge bodies and these tiny little pinheads on top of them. I just thought that doesn't look right for an underdog, really. So, my daughter, Caitlin, she's 17, a big fan of Skins. She said, what are you doing all that for? You should see that guy in Skins. I mean, seriously, she said that to me. I suddenly remembered him. I thought, yeah. And anyway, we met him and he was absolutely fantastic. And so we took him. He's the only guy from here that we took there to make the film.
Danny Boyle is here. He has a new movie. It's called Slumdog Millionaire. It's quite extraordinary to have... Because I can imagine people tuning into this. OK, fine, I understand the story. This sounds intriguing. But the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire sequence... is the spine of the film. I mean, there's the music we know, the setup we know, the whole style we know, and Celador were involved in the production. Well, I mean, presumably they had to be because it belongs to them.
Well, it doesn't actually. We're really getting into money today, aren't we? They sold it like about 3 years ago for a staggering amount of money. They developed it, invented it, and developed it, and they sold it. And they've used the money they made to set up this film production company. They wisely inserted in the contract when they sold it the right to make a film about it, should it ever arise. And so Tessa Ross at Channel 4 sent this book to Simon Beaufoy.
It's a book called Q&A.
Q&A by this guy, Vikas Swarup, who's a diplomat. But he came up with this. It's very different than the book, but it's the central idea of the kid going on the show. And then when Simon Beaufoy wrote the full Monty, done the script, they sent it to Celador because it seemed sensible, because they'd be the only people who could be able to get the rights, really. And so we had freedom, really, with the show. The show is the same all around the world, apart from language sometimes. But everything's the same, the set, the music, all that, the format. And you'd never get it normally, because especially with some of the things that go on in the film, a lot of kind of corporate companies wouldn't want to be associated with some of it, you know, in the way, because they're so conscious of their images. But Celador had the right to use it exclusively, and so we got a free hand with all that.
Which is great. I was just hoping that the soundtrack album, which I'd be very interested in hearing, just doesn't have the millionaire music on there anyway. Just to tell us about a couple of the scenes, just to whet people's appetite on this. And I wish we had some clips, but they're not available yet, because actually the movie isn't out for quite a while.
I know.
But some of the standout scenes, very early on, explain how our hero... early on in this story, gets to find himself covered in excrement. shall we say. It's a great sequence in the film.
It's a great toilet sequence.
Yes.
It's funny doing films, you know, because when you go around the world, there's very few countries that have scenes in toilets in their films, and yet British films, we just seem to love scenes in toilets. And we have two, actually. We have one later on as well. This particular one is an extraordinary scene, and it says everything you need to know about this character. He's 7 years old, and his big hero is Amitabh Bachchan, who is the biggest movie star there's ever been in India. And he's flying in his helicopter next door to the slum, and the kid gets locked inside a toilet and he can't get out, and he wants to get to Amitabh and get his autograph.
It's a big open toilet on the end of a pier.
Yeah, because it's kind of a dumping ground. They don't have proper toilets in the slums. They just do it next door, really. So he's trapped inside this cubicle, this kind of self-made, kind of ready-made cubicle. And there is only one way out, which is obviously the exit, downwards. And he is prepared to do that in order to get to Amitabh Bachchan. What he finds, of course, by going with his better instincts and doing it, he finds everybody clears out of his way because they smell him coming. And they let him all the way through to Amitabh Bachchan. And Amitabh Bachchan, who is known for this, of course, is actually a very, very gracious man. And he duly signs his autograph. And the kid is temporarily very, very happy.
Yes. And does it say anything about money and excrement?
It's I don't know. It's very important that the kid is not after money. That's what his focus is, not actually money. And I must admit, when they first sent the script, they said it's a film about Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and I thought, I don't want to make a film about that. I mean, I watch it like we all do. You get hooked on it. It's very addictive. But I'm not sure I kind of like approve of it really as a kind of, and it's like it's just about to open in Afghanistan as a show. So it shows how we all over the world were addicted to it.
You might not approve of it because
I just think that the offer of incredible riches and wealth instantly is an illusion really for most people. And it's very dangerous, I think, sometimes to offer that really, rather than people. It's much better that you work your way in life. I think we all kind of know that really. As I said at the beginning, his focus is somewhere else. He happens to win the money, which pleases the Americans who watch the film. But actually, that's really not what he's bothered about. He's bothered about something else.
Yes, because, again, it would be easy to give the wrong impression in the course of this interview. You know, people thinking, I don't want to go and see a film that's about Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. But actually, it's a love story.
Yes.
In there, somewhere.
He has lost this girl in the chaos, and it is a chaotic city, the chaos of Mumbai. And the only thing he knows is that she watches this show. She's kind of addicted to watching this show. And he figures if he stays on it long enough, she might see him and they can get back together again. So that's his plan. And he will do anything. He'll summon up any of the gods that he can in order to answer any of the questions in order to stay on there longer and longer. Meanwhile, he's accruing staggering wealth as he goes along.
So it's an adventure story. It's a love story. It's funny. It has some great comedy moments, as we've just been talking about. And actually, a couple of stomach-churningly horrible scenes, particularly, I mean, I don't know how much, well, I'll let you explain what you want to explain. I don't want to spoil it for everyone going to see it. But there's a moment where the audience last night, including me, were going, oh, no, you know, just want to look away.
There's some pretty tough stuff in it, especially early on. I mean, the truth is, we wanted it to be a very realistic film about Mumbai. And it's a very joyous film because the city actually is an incredible place to be. But there is a very tough side to it as well. And there are a couple of scenes early on which people will wince at, really, especially involving little kids. There's a couple of little kids in it. And the hero, when he's 7 years old, and his brother and this girl. And they are in serious jeopardy, let's put it like that. But I think I've had a lot of people said that they nearly walked out there when they saw those kind of things happening. But I think
you're thinking if there's more of this, you know, there's only a limit.
If it's going
to
go like this, I can't take some. But there isn't, and it's kind of like the film is redemptive ultimately, and it reflects really like my and Simon's experience in being in Mumbai. It's an extraordinary city with a very tough side, but it's actually an incredibly generous and warm city, you know, and it's full of the vivacity of life, the sense of life going on there is incredible in all its ugliness and all its beauty as well.
Mark Kermode's joined us, and I think I'm ahead of the curve on this, Mark, aren't I? Because I don't think you've seen this film.
No, I think I'm the only person on earth who hasn't seen it now. In fact, you were at that festival, I think it was Toronto or something, you won an audience award, and I sent Danny a text saying, I see that you've won the audience award, and incidentally, I noticed that your friend Brian Cox didn't manage to bring about the end of the world by switching on his Large Hadron Collider. And then Danny sent me back a text saying, yes, why aren't you here? Why aren't you watching this film? And ever since then, I've completely managed to avoid it. And now, hearing you talk about it, I'm even more cross that I haven't seen it. But everyone I know says it's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, we've had a very, very good time, Mark. It's been very, we've been very lucky. We were kind of dead, to be honest, about 8 weeks ago.
Just explain that, because now we have this film which is being talked about in such joyful terms, in glowing terms, you know, outside chance of Oscars, all this kind of stuff, and yet it nearly didn't happen.
Yeah, about 8 weeks ago, we lost our North American distributor, which for a film like this is normally, it would be a catastrophe. And what happened is that these film festivals in America, Telluride and Toronto, Toronto in Canada, obviously, they started to express an interest in it. They got a whiff of it. Now, quite how they did that, I'm not sure. there's a lot of politics goes on behind the scenes in America, and they started to ask to see it. And of course, that's when Warner Brothers started to get nervous about the fact that they closed their independent division, so there was nobody to distribute the film. And so they showed the film to Fox Searchlight, who've distributed all my other films, and they loved it and went for it and put it in Toronto, and it won this big People Prize. And it shows you, you've always got to remember, especially someone like me who has a bit of a reputation, you've got to remember how important festivals are, film festivals. They actually give a platform to films that are orphans, you know? And some of them deserve to be orphans, frankly, but some of them don't. Yeah. Some of them deserve a better chance, you know? And so we were very fortunate to close the London Film Festival last night. And you should always... It's a lesson for me to always remember how important festivals are.
And I think it also has a sort of a word-of-mouth feel about it as well, that people will go and say, have you heard this? Heard about this Slumdog... You know, it's going to be one of those... much talked about films. I don't know about what your advertising budget is, but people will hear about it and think, I want to be a part of that.
Hope so, because it's what executives in Hollywood, they don't know. They know the public know. That's all they know, and they try and guess what the public are like. And of course, a film festival allows you to give the public a little bit of a glimpse of it, and suddenly they're alert because the public seem to like it. And it does, they're going to market it on word of mouth. They're going to do word of mouth screenings so that hopefully the word will pass amongst people that it's a film to come along to. Yeah,
just trying to think what else we can say to make Mark feel really mad that he's the only one.
Okay, right. In that case, can I leap in and say, since I am one of the very few people in the world who's seen Alien Love Triangle, the great lost Danny Boyle film, which we ended up showing in a shed in Wales, is there any chance of that now getting released? Because it now has been seen. Is there any movement on it, Danny?
There isn't yet, but I hope there will be. I'd like to. My ambition for it would be to get it together with a few other lost films. There's a Todd Haynes films about the Carpenters.
Superstar.
Yeah, which has, again, never been released. There's a few films out there like that where you think, wouldn't it be wonderful to put together a DVD of a lot of films like that that, for whatever reason, they've never been properly released?
It's Five Live. We're talking movies with Mark. And Danny Boyle is still here. Slumdog Millionaire is his film. Got some questions for you, Danny. Here.
All right.
Well, this is from Trevor Phillips. Now, I don't know whether it's the Trevor Phillips. There's a text and it says Trevor Phillips at the end. So... maybe it is. I was lucky enough to see Slumdog last night. Do you know if he was there?
I didn't notice him, no.
Could have been any Trevor.
Could be another Trevor film.
Anyway, I was lucky enough to see Slumdog last night. Please tell Danny it is a wonderful film, and with each film he makes, I am constantly impressed with his use of new filming and storytelling techniques.
Whichever Trevor you are, thank you, Trevor. It's very kind.
Is he right that you are using new filming and storytelling techniques, or just relying on a few old ones?
Well, we try to give the impression we're creating new ones. We use a lot of digital camera work in it. Amazing camera work. That should make Mark jealous. The cinematography.
Oh, yes, Mark, you'd have
Anthony Dodmantle, you'd have loved that cinematography,
the
Mark.
The colours are fantastic.
The colours are fantastic. The music.
The sound is terrific. Boy,
there you go.
If anyway. You weren't there last night, you were nowhere.
So we used a lot of digital cameras on it, and because they were very small, very flexible for use in the slum, particularly very small avenues and corridors that they run through and things like that. So it's we try to use those as much as possible. We did about 70% or 80% of the film on that. The really interesting thing about the film is that for me, and it comes from the script, is that you see this kid at three different ages. You see him at 7, 12, and 18 years old. And you also see him being interviewed by the police and partly tortured by the police at one point, and you see him on the show. So that's five different timescales. And yet the idea of the film was that you never feel any of them were flashbacks. They all feel like present day. They're all happening now. They've got an immediacy now. That was very exciting because I'd never done anything like that. I'd never thought of... Normally, the convention is if you're showing something in the past, you have to be very clear. People know it's in the past and differentiate the periods you're looking at if you're constantly referring to them.
I just want to mention the credits at the end, without again wanting to give it too much weight. Stay for the credits. Don't go as soon as the film starts. I mean, can you tell us about that? I mean, it's absolutely. So it's not and people might be thinking it was a series of outtakes or one of those kind of things. It's not. I've never seen it done in this kind of film before. Is it an Indian tradition?
No, I'm sure it is. I was there for about a year altogether, and you can't live and work in Mumbai and not dance, really. You've got to dance at some point because
I'm sure English people could.
But it'd be like showing a film about America and not showing motor cars, you know? It's like, so there is a moment at the end of the film which is a celebration of the union of this couple, and you should try and stay for it if you can. It's during the immediate credits, yeah.
I mean, I think it's one of my favourite films of the year. I mean, I just think it's... That's what I want. When are you going to get to see this, Mark? So you
Mark,
can join
you've
in.
Missed his favourite film of the year.
Mark can't even join in this conversation.
I was going to say, you know, bear in mind, Danny, when he says it's one of his favourite films of the year, he's only seen about three. So you know, it's that and Mamma Mia. I think was the other one.
I haven't seen Mamma Mia.
No, you haven't seen Mamma Mia. No. You missed that. That was one of my favourite films of the year. But I'm sure this will be even better. Listen, the question I wanted to ask was: I interviewed Robert Carlyle not so long ago, and he said then, as he said before, that there was definitely interest in doing this. The follow-up to Trainspotting. Has there been any movement on that at all? Because it was people were talking about doing it and then not doing it. Is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen?
There has been a little bit of movement on it, actually. And it's kind of slightly coincidental movement. But they're putting out a new DVD of the film, which they do, of course. They withdraw it from the shops for 18
and
months.
Put it out again every 4 years.
Put it out again at full price. But they got all the actors together to do new interviews for it. And they all got together and did it and did some lovely interviews. So you can feel that they're kind of like... It sort of feels like they're sort of gathering together and that slowly they'll come around to the idea of doing it, I think. I mean, it's got to... We want to do it... We don't want to just make a copy of the first one. We wanted to do something very new. And we wanted to follow the pattern of The Likely Lads. Do you remember The Likely Lads? And they followed it up with that amazing series, Whatever Happened to The Likely Lads. And that period of time when these characters that were so important to you, that were part of your life in a way... had aged, and you saw what had happened to them in the time that had passed. And we wanted to try and do this with these characters in the same city, with the same actors playing the same guys. Yeah.
Well, I think that was the thing that he was saying was the real appeal for him, was the idea that that character, which had become so iconic, maybe it would have moved on, and how he would have changed, and how much he would have changed by simply growing up. And, I mean, he sounded really, really keen on it. So, I mean, I'd love to see it happen.
It would be nice, wouldn't it? I mean, he's the trigger for it, because he'd... In the book that Irving Welsh wrote, was a sequel to the book Trainspotting, Porno, he's the trigger for it because he's in jail. He's been in jail for 10, 15, whatever years it is, for some terrible crime. And he somehow gets out of jail. In fact, if I remember rightly, he gets out of jail in a really good way. And he re-triggers the relationship between them all.
Okay.
This from Ed in Dublin. Simon, could you please put the questions to Danny Boyle, please? One, is the soundtrack for Sunshine ever going to be released?
I believe it's about to be released, finally. They've settled all their kind of disputes, whatever they were.
Why has that been such a to-do?
I don't know. I think it was to do with... There were two composers involved. There was Underworld on the one hand, which is Carl and Rick, and there was John Murphy on the other hand, who's a composer I work with in... he's a Scouser, but he lives in America now. And I think they couldn't agree on how to release it or something. There was some legal stuff going on. But they finally come to an agreement, and it will be out, yes.
I mean,
very soon.
Once people get a chance to see Slumdog, they'll want a copy of the soundtrack of that. Is that MIA that you've got on there?
She's on it. She's heard that great song of hers, Paper Planes, is used. But I asked her, could we use it? And I'd like them to come in and watch the film if the song's going to be on it. And she came in and watched the film, very smart woman, and gave me a couple of really good notes, really good notes. She said, do you want any notes on it? She said, I liked it very much. Do you want any notes? I said, all right, then. And she said, well, if you do that there and do that there. And they were really good notes, the kind of notes you hope for, you know, that you're going to get. So she's on it. But the music is done by this amazing composer, A.R. Rahman, who's like a kind of god in India. And he's an extraordinary composer. And the music, which is this fusion of traditional Indian and hip-hop and R&B and house music, it's all kind of fused together in this kind of... And they mix music there in movies really up front. It's really like... They don't hide the music behind you subtly. It's like, here's the music, everybody. Bang!
And Roland in Korea, Dear George and Bungle, which is a reference to me, Mark, and I'm not sure which is which. Please thank Danny for making Millions. It's one of the most touching films I've ever seen. I'll be interested to see more of his work. Roland's listening in Korea. So,
wow, cool. Thanks,
so
Roland.
You have to go, I'm told, Danny. So the key thing to say is then Slumdog is going to be out, but we're going to have to wait for some time. But distribution in this country is sorted. It is going to happen. The future is good.
The future looks bright.
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
January 9th, definitely in Britain, yeah.
Oscar talk, have you heard that?
There is, but you have to remain utterly, naively modest about the whole thing, otherwise it just gets to you, you know, so...
Although, but the People Prize is generally seen as some kind of indicator to... Isn't it? If you get the People Prize, the likelihood of being nominated does increase, doesn't it?
So they say, Mark,
Anyway, let's not tempt fate.
Absolutely.
Danny, always good to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Thanks, Simon. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
OK, Danny Boyle, look out for Slumdog Millionaire, and maybe we'll talk to Danny again round about Oscar time.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.